Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Hey, it's Phil, and you're about to experience a conversation with Ryan Hawke, a former athlete turned leadership expert who on his Learning Leader podcast has published over 500 episodes. He's written 3 books, and we're going to be talking about one of those books today called The Score That Matters. You're going to love this conversation. So without further ado, let's meet and talk with Ryan Hawke.
9 years ago, I started the Learning Leader Show as a way to follow my own curiosity and obsessions with great rigor. I wanted to create my own form of a leadership PhD program where I got to personally choose all of my teachers as well as ask them what I'm most interested in. I had no idea that it would have turned into this.
You get more by giving first. It's literally like having a lost leader in business.
A lot of top performers in different areas, they have incredibly high agency.
You have to be disciplined about being a provider. You have to have a sense of what is enough also.
Any leader who suggests they know the way is going to be wrong in a matter of months.
Do a lot of shows. No one's done this kind of research before.
And striving to learn from each of them. So I'm so grateful for what I get to do, and I'm pumped to keep this thing going. Now, if you are looking to level up your leadership, you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Learning Leader Show.
Well, everyone, I couldn't be happier to introduce you to Ryan Hawke. And if you're not familiar with Ryan Hawke and his work in leadership, it is immense. And over the last 8+ years, Ryan has recorded over 500 episodes, written 3 books. We're going to spend time talking with him today about a very particular book that just got released, and we're going to add a partnerships angle to it, because what we talk about here, obviously, is partnerships, and we want to know a lot more about how Ryan and his team have built some remarkable partnerships. When you go into his back catalogue and see the kind of work that he's built with companies all around the US and beyond, it's really something else. So, Ryan, great to see you.
Thanks for having me, Phil. I appreciate your support, your preparation. I saw all of your notes, man. It means a lot to me that you put so much work into this. And also the fact that it's, you know, close to midnight your time. I didn't fully realize that when we booked this. So I'm very, very appreciative of you, man.
You bet. So look, we're going to dive straight into this. And let's start with your backstory, because as I was reading through your most recent publication, we're going to put that on screen now, and then we're also going to link to it. Tell me about what the backstory was that got you to the point where leadership became such an important part of your life. And then maybe a little bit about your co-author, Brooke Cupps, in The Score That Matters. So let's start with your backstory.
Going between my 8th grade and freshman year, legendary high school football coach Bob Gregg at Central High School came to me as this small, skinny 8th grader and said, "We think there's a chance you could help our football team, the varsity football team, not the freshman team, which I expected to play on, but the actual varsity team at Centerville High School, which is a tradition-rich Division I, which is the biggest division in the state of Ohio here in the States. We think you could help us." I think there's a lot I could say about Coach Gregg and Coach Ron Ollery, which I've written about those guys a lot and spoken about them a lot. But what I learned early on, starting then, is that there is so much power in somebody believing in somebody else and somebody supporting them and somebody telling them that they believe in them and then somebody pushing and pushing and pushing that person to lift your level to higher than even you think you are capable of. That's right. Leadership. And so I got this great taste of what the power of leadership in my formative years. And I think that is something that I thought, is there a chance that I could be that for others? Is there a chance that I could do the same that Coach Gregg and Coach Ollery did for me? And now many others since then, but that was like my first taste of the power of what leaders can do. And so I played in high school, I played in college, and I played a little bit after college, and I played quarterback, which is a leadership position in American football. And then, you know, when I got in the business world, I wanted to be in leadership positions, and I earned some of those roles as well. And so it's it's really been a part of my life since I was quite young. And now I love that it's my life's work is leading people and helping other leaders become more effective. So it started pretty young. And now it's really like the thing I think about the most.
And what I find interesting in your backstory is that everything here seems to have been hard won. So I'm not talking to somebody who has had a great idea, built a multi-trillion dollar company and exited. You started as a sales guy on the phones, worked all the way through, did the hard work, understands what it takes to have a conversation, to sell something to complete strangers. And so you know how to talk and converse with people. Why was it that there was a leap then into podcasting and conversations and interviews? When I've gone and listened to the Tony Robbins conversation you've had, it was all about at that time him having conversations with the smartest financial people in the world to inform him of what was going on. I feel as though there's a theme there with you where it was, I need to talk to as many people who have lived leadership and philosophy and understand this world to build out your own knowledge set. Am I on the right track with that?
100%. I was working in sales. I had gotten my MBA. It took me 6 years. I was doing it at night while working full time. My company paid for that. They reimbursed me for that. And so when I finished that, I felt like I was wasting money and resources by not going back to school again and furthering my education and getting another degree, another master's degree, or perhaps even a PhD. I actually had looked into programs, PhD programs in management and leadership. I'd started applying to them, but I didn't love every element of formal education to get my MBA. It was a grind. I had to hire tutors. I struggled. You know, I was working a lot. And so I thought, is there a way that I could use some of the skills I've developed building teams where I worked at LexisNexis? Because at that point, I was in management and leadership roles where I was hiring for my own teams. I was helping others hire for theirs. And when you're hiring, you're obviously interviewing people. Now, interviewing for a podcast is different than interviewing for a job, but there are some similarities, right? You got to listen. You got to be prepared. You got to ask good follow-up questions, right? All of that. Got to get to know a person really well. So I thought, is there a better way to create my own form of a leadership PhD program as opposed to actually going back to school again? I was listening to podcasts at the time. Now, this is about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Listening to podcasts at the time. So I was a fan of podcasts. I understood the medium relatively well, even though it wasn't nearly as crowded as it is today. And thought, well, what if I created my own form of a leadership PhD program where I get to choose all of the professors? And it gives me probably a better chance for these well-known people to speak to me if I've created some sort of a platform like a podcast, as opposed to saying, hey, can I call you? I could say, hey, can I interview you for my podcast? And it increased the hit rate that they would say yes. And I'll publish all of these so others could learn along with me. And maybe we form some sort of learning leader community. That was more of a pipe dream. I didn't know if there was any chance that that would happen, but so I started that on the side. I didn't have any intentions to leave my job or to leave my team or leave my company. I just really wanted to create my own form of leadership PhD program that was ongoing and I could chase my curiosity with great rigor. And that was it. I mean, the reward was that I got to do that. And so there wasn't some ambition or some desire or even any money. I mean, I lost money for the first 3 years doing it. It was really about me getting to follow what I'm most curious about. That's learning from leaders who have done really great work. I could get to the story now, but I mean, yeah, long story short is it created so many really cool opportunities for me to then go out and share what I was learning with others in the forms of keynote speaking and advising leaders and consulting with companies and, you know, I had to create offerings and like actually make a real business that I decided to leave corporate America and at the end of 2017 and launch my own business. And, you know, now here we are in 2024 and a few books later, a lot of really cool opportunities and relationships built. And now this is what I get to do full time. And I have my own, my team, and it's I feel very fortunate to get a chance to do it. And I think that's part of the reward is that you get to work with amazing people. I get to record these cool podcasts and write books and team up with others that I really admire. And I didn't really think that was ever possible. And now I'm kind of doing it. So that's the part that I'll always be grateful for.
So there's been three books. Let me see if I get this right. Welcome to Management, Pursuit of Excellence, and now The Score That Matters. Mm-hmm. I've just finished The Score That Matters, and it came out at a pretty interesting time for me personally and with other people in my circles as well. I want to spend some time diving into a couple of really poignant parts of this, which I think will be high value to people who are listening to this, and encouraging anybody who's listening to really think about either listening to the book, which is really beautifully co-authored by both you and Brooke, but has a mm-hmm. chance to sort of, you can hear both of your voices right throughout this very practical almanac of insight. So when we talk about that partnership with you and Brooke, so he is a professional teacher and sports coach. He seems like he is just such a dedicated educator, and the world needs so many more people like him doing what is probably the world's most difficult job, particularly right now. Tell me a little bit about how you got to know Brooke, what the backstory to that relationship is. And I remember hearing him say somewhere that it took a while for him to come to you and then start this process because, like me, he'd admired you from a distance for a while, and then a relationship was built, and ultimately then the process of writing a book became something real. How did that come about?
He sent me a cold email asking me to speak to a leadership group that he had assembled, which was essentially team captains from all the sports teams, and then as well as leaders from other groups within Centerville High School. That's where I went to school. That's where he teaches and coaches the basketball team. Really well-written note. I never heard of him. I had not paid much attention to the school because my kids were much younger and not high school age. So, you know, when you have kids, you're kind of into what they're into. And so I never heard of him. I didn't know who he was. I didn't pay any attention. I went there that first day to speak to his group and was immediately struck by how comfortable he was in his own skin. We talked a little bit about his values, and he just seemed to kind of do what he does without this need for approval of others. And I admire that. I'm attracted to that. I think that's a really rare quality in a person. And so I think the talk went fine with the group. We kept talking back and forth, and then I asked him to speak at one of my events, one of my Learning Leader Growth Summits, where I have a lot of my clients and Learning Leader Circle members come. He initially was hesitant to do it. He didn't think he was a fit for, there's a lot of corporate America type people and international people as well that are senior leaders at companies, big and small. And I just said, I wouldn't ask you if I didn't think you could possibly impact them. Like, I think my group trust me to vet the speakers. So anyway, he came, he crushed it. And I did a survey at the end of the event. I had probably four or five speakers. All the other ones were professionally paid, like big time speakers. Wow. And Brooke's name was listed as the most favorite speaker of the event. He joined one of my leadership circles, and we just kept it going. We just kept it going, and we've never stopped. And that's been, again, 6-7 years ago, I guess. And we've maintained dialogue. And then fast forward to a few years ago, we were going to sit down and record an online course. And we brought my camera guys and our lights, and we had the whole setup. And I had one extra person show up, and that was my friend Dan Smith. And I said, will you just type everything that we say? I want a transcript of this day. I want you to document everything. And so Brooke and I did our thing. We did a lot of riffing, a lot of talking in between filming. We did all of it. Dan wrote all of it down. And I spent a good amount of time reading that transcript. And I texted Brooke and I said, hey, man, I think this could be a book. What do you think? And he said, I'm down. You know, 2.5 years Amazing. Later, we have the artifact. So, yeah, there's a lot there. But I think what helps is there is a lot of mutual respect. I don't know if it's possible to do a project like a book if there isn't a lot of mutual respect. And that's what I'm, again, very grateful for, because I view him as a mentor. And I think we both can kind of lean on each other for certain elements in our lives to be helpful. And I love him and love what he stands for.
It's a powerful story. Let me just read you a quote that he had in the book, which we'll dive into some thoughts, which I know you have in the book as well. So Brooke said, you may not be able to change much about an external situation, but you have full control over your attitude, mentality, and response. By doing this, you unlock the ability to transform your fear from an obstacle into fuel. And then in the same chapter, you went on to say that you had quite a significant fear of failing most of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think in the work you've done to date and the progress you've made through your life, is that a common feature for people who are trying to strive? Or is that something which we can ascribe to people who are just very ambitious?
One of the people I quoted was the lead speechwriter for President Barack Obama, who I interviewed, and he said fear was the ultimate fuel for him. I think it's been for me. I think I would potentially, and I've written about this, but potentially rephrase it and with a nod to another person who's been on my podcast, Jim Collins, which is I think it's more of a productive paranoia. Right, which Jim and I talked about when we recorded, and he's written in his book, Good to Great and Great by Choice. But productive paranoia is more of this feeling of I've got to do whatever I can to be overly prepared for the series of moments in my life. And my whole business is built with like really a series of big moments, podcasts, keynote speeches, consulting with companies, like everything that you do. They're looking to you to provide some sort of, I guess, viewpoint that's going to make them better. That's a high pressure situation. You have to be on all the time. You got to be ready. And so to me, I think this productive paranoia is the fact that you're not always working, but you kind of are. You're always preparing. You're always thinking about it. Like my podcast or a keynote or a big moment with a client, I'm thinking about that before I go to bed. I'm thinking about that when I wake up. I think about that in the middle of the night when I wake up. Like, I'm thinking about this all the time. And so some would say, well, that's, I don't know if that's healthy or that's an obsession. Well, it is. I would say there is a little bit of obsessiveness with that. But in a way, that's also part of the edge. That's part of what makes you good. And so to me, that is a signal that I'm doing my life's work, that I'm doing what I should be doing. And when you study people who have sustained excellence over time, that does seem to be a commonality among them, is like if they are doing their life's work, they are in a way always thinking about it, always working. And I don't necessarily know if that's a bad thing. I just think that's reality.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I wonder, you know, you then moved into a conversation about your purpose. And what Brooke had been able to put as his purpose resonated very, very strongly. Before I share that sort of insert for what he had said, you talk about a process you've gone through to define purpose. And it seems like it's been a process over time. I think you mentioned in your part of this book that you started with something like 20 plus values that you ended up having to refine over time. It was on your kitchen wall, I think, at one point where you were saying, this is the Hawke family values, we're going to try and aspire to doing this. And now it's become a lot more refined. There's a lot of people who will be listening to this as senior leaders, particularly partnership-driven leaders, where a lot of my work tends to be with new CEOs who have inherited a business, come into a new company. They know that given the current global economic turmoil that's going on, they've got to find ways to partner, to grow, to build even stronger supply chains, to make that worthwhile. And there will be a very strong sense for them about how they define their purpose and how they're going to lead through a huge amount of difficulty that we're probably going to face for the next sort of 4 to 5 years. What would be a way that you would suggest, if they've heard of this, maybe even eye-rolled at the idea of having a purpose and trying to invest time in doing that, how would you encourage them to think about purpose and the power that can be unlocked as a consequence of getting clarity on their own purpose?
I mean, my purpose is to inspire others to both value and pursue excellence. So I just think it's worth it to document what are you trying to do here and why are you doing it and what's it all about, so you can expand on it. So what is that? If you break that down, I need to live in a way that inspires other people to take some sort of action, because I think your purpose always should involve, at least I would hope it involves, helping other people.
Right.
In some way, shape, or form of using, whether it's your talents or your skills or your gifts. And so What's the downside to coming up with your personal purpose or with the purpose of your company? What's the downside? I don't see any. Yep. Right. At minimum, you're going to do some reflective work. You're going to write. You're going to think. You're going to get hopefully a little bit more clear on why you do what you do. And so to me, I added in that word value and pursue excellence. And I would define excellence as the gradual result of always striving to do better. It comes from Pat Riley, Hall of Fame coach. And so to me, I don't think enough people value excellence. I think there are too many that are okay with mediocrity. And so I hope by the way I show up, by the way I design my studio, by the way I produce work, by the way I am here, that's saying I value excellence. I value having a very high quality bar, and I hope my actions inspire you to do that as well. And then be in pursuit of it. This pursuit is this never arrived, always becoming mindset, meaning regardless of what we accomplish, we're always striving for an upward like trajectory like this, as opposed to just being okay with mediocrity or being okay with the status quo. I want to be pushing those edges. And so I have to live in a way, and I want to live in a way that inspires others to do that as well. And if you haven't taken time to think about your purpose, all of that stuff I just said, you don't know what that is for you. And I revert back to, what is the downside? There's only upside. So when at all possible in life in general, try to do things that have high upside and almost no downside. What's the worst that happens is that you think a lot about yourself, that you get reflective, that you create some sort of maxim to live, no downside. So to me, that's why I feel like everybody should do that. And unless you really don't care, like if you just are here to exist and to wander around and to hope for the best, you're probably not listening to this podcast. Yeah. You're not definitely not listening to mine either. Like you're not reading books. So they would not take the time to do this. So that's why I think it's worth it. And Brooke was a huge help for me when it came to getting my values down to four, as well as understanding what my purpose is.
So he took it a step further for me, at least, where it was this comparison, ironically, between the term success. We're all seemingly societally geared towards this idea of comparison, in other words, success, and the difference between that and the pursuit of excellence. And I find it really quite something that comparison can be so simple but so profound. So whenever we're talking about this idea of success, we're obviously looking at a number, we're trying to compare against another company, another return, another score, that when you get to that mountain, whatever that is, you say a number of times in the book that it can feel like a holy victory because it's a fleeting moment. You get there and it's like, well, what happens now? And I think we've all felt that we've hit pinnacle moments. Whereas the idea of being excellent and that idea of trying to always show up and be the best you can be is something which I don't think people quite understand and have given themselves permission to try and sort of engage on that. So when somebody is saying, and I made this mention to someone in a keynote the other day, one of the key things that I enjoy most in every day is for our kids, we've got young girls, the first thing in my day is the first hug of the morning. I look forward to that more than anything else in the world. The second thing I look forward to in the day is being excellent. And often that manifests at 5 o'clock in the morning when I'm in the gym and I don't want to pick up another weight. I don't want to do another rep. And I find myself saying, be excellent. And somehow there is this extra bit of energy to complete the piece. And then you move on to the next part of your day. And I find that to be something which has unlocked recently for me and for others I've mentioned to it. A very, very different level. So I just want to say thank you for that, because that sometimes you've got to find the language and the comparison to make that work. And that has absolutely been a fantastic part of what's gone on here.
Oh, I love that story, especially the first hug, as well as be excellent. Like I as you know from reading our book, like we really like mantras and ethoses, and we like simple phrases to keep you on track or to get you on back, get back on track if you're off. And I remember I was talking to James Clear about this last year at our Growth Summit, and we were saying the difference between like consistent high performers versus those who are not. And it's on those days at 5 a.m. when you don't feel like it. Maybe for whatever reason, you didn't get enough sleep or your body's not acting the way you want it to act. It's the difference are the people who show up on the days when they don't feel like it. Because when we're good and we feel good, everybody's pretty good. Like we're all good. The difference is what happens on the days when you're not feeling it, you push and push. And again, I learned that early on from amazing football coaches, but that I feel like is a differentiator. Just was talking to my wife this morning about that. Like one of the things that we try to share as parents and try to model as parents for our daughters is the same thing, that we're not always going to be feeling it, but we're always going to show up and do the work. And if you do that, and we're always going to show up and be there for them and be present in those moments. And I think if you do that consistently over time, one, it builds trust, but also the work that you want to accomplish seems to get done if you have that mentality, versus you're like, oh, you're inconsistent, which you're going to be less trustworthy and less dependable and less reliable. And a lot of those words aren't very sexy, but they're very effective. And I think that's ultimately what we're trying to do, like be really effective as leaders, be effective as parents. And that comes with a lot of unsexy words, but very meaningful and important ones.
You mentioned mantras before and talked about this idea of gestures. And so I think it was a failure reset system. This idea of
an effort button right on your shoulder. Yeah. This is
exactly
a real thing.
So, yeah. So there's some kind of physical action that you commit to break the doubt, fear kind of cycle that might have happened as a consequence of something that's just happened in life. And on the sporting field, being a women's football coach, you know, you see some of the girls sometimes really come down on themselves hard for a misstep, a missed kick, a missed pass, and you can just see the doubt creep in, and that can cascade pretty hard and fast. And what we've taught, thanks to your teachings, is this idea of having that effort button where you're able to touch something. You can do any kind of physical thing you want to do to sort of shake yourself out and keep moving. That started, and then we built on the back of that by scoring the number of times encouragement was offered by a teammate to another teammate. And that was probably the second insight that I remember I was doing the gardening at the time, and I think, I can't remember if it was you or Brooke that said this, but there was a way in which they score, you counted the number of times that there were touches between team members to demonstrate how that kind of affection and that kind of encouragement kept on propelling the team forward. We're now doing that. And it's interesting because we spend a lot of time not talking about the scoreline. What was the score? And we straight away divert to congratulations to girl A who ended up doing the most touches during the game. And it's funny how it's resetting the mind of these 12-year-old girls who are for the first time playing a reasonably competitive sport and understanding what the real cohesion is for a small team. And I'm kind of hoping that this kind of behavior that we're instilling them is going to carry them through to the rest of their careers in sport, because it's a pretty interesting thing to observe once they realize why it is that we're doing that measurement.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, one of Brooke's values is thankful. It's one we share, but the critical behavior for that is showing love. And one of the ways that they actually measure this on their basketball team, they film every practice, film every game, is the number of touches.
Right.
There is something with the physical act of touching. And so if somebody gets knocked down, obviously they all come and pick up their teammate. If somebody makes a mistake, everybody has to get a touch. So every time after there's a mistake made, you'll watch, and I go to a lot of their games, I watch them on film, everybody will get a touch on the guy. And the guy knows that they're going to get a touch. Like, this happens at practice all the time, and it happens in the games. And you could tell the players, it just becomes unconscious. That's just how they behave. And so I think this kind of failure recovery system is important. You have one for yourself, and if you're part of a team, you have one for your team. And that this is an actual physical act that gets you back in gear, because especially in sports or in life, we got to be good about responding to the moments that don't go our way, so that we don't create this negative momentum, whether, again, this is in a game or this is in life. And so creating a system for yourself that is uniquely yours is very useful, so that when those moments of adversity strike, which we know they will, that's one of the only guarantees of life, is that adversity will strike. How will you choose to respond? And that is your choice. Comes from Tim and Brian Kite. E plus R equals O. A lot of people have seen that equation. E is the event. R is your response, will then determine the O, the outcome. And so we focus really hard on that R, because we can't predict the events, but our R will help predict the O, the outcome. And so that is where a lot of the focus arises, because we know adversity is going to strike. How are we going to choose to respond, whether it's as a dad, or whether it's on the court, or whether it's in a big business meeting that you mess something up, or something happens that you weren't planning for, right? How are you going to choose to respond? That's going to be the determining factor in the outcomes you have in life, I think.
And there is no downside to encouragement, ever.
No way. Right? Not at all. I mean, it's haven't, again, we this has been a theme of our conversation, right? Like, why not do things with unlimited upside and no downside?
Exactly.
Seems kind of like a no-brainer. I certainly not a waste of time. I think it's a good use of time. So yeah, encouragement, being a good teammate. That's one of the biggest conversations we have at our house with our girls is defining, you know, what it means to be a good teammate. And a number of the things that come up are picking them up physically when they're down, but picking them up emotionally when they're down, being supportive, cheering for them loudly, chest bumping, high fives when it goes well, right? Being a good teammate is all of those things. It's being focused on others and lifting them up, whether things are going well or things are not. That's part of being a good teammate. And that translates to all elements of life. That's partially, I mean, I am biased, but that is a big part of why I enjoy team sports, is because so much of it translates to regular life outside of sports.
Let's double click on that for a minute. What is it around that thoughtful gratitude that has happened to you in your life, which has become sort of hardwired? Because you've talked about this a number of times, not just in this book, but also in other podcast episodes. I've heard that in your voice, and that intention is very, very strong. Are there a couple of moments that were really significant for you that sort of cemented that desire for you to pay that forward, the idea of being really thoughtful in the gratitude that you've received and pay forward?
Well, I mean, the critical behavior that goes along with one of my core values are thoughtful, thankful, curious, and consistent. And my thankful value, the critical behavior, is leave it better. Leave people, places, and things better than I found them. I think when you're given a lot, you should give a lot. Mm-hmm. I've been given a ton and continue to be given a ton. Born with amazing parents. I'm the middle of three boys, amazingly supportive brothers, never wanted for anything. My parents worked very hard to provide for us. They're very present, and also the model for what it means to have a great relationship, still are, right? I just went on a walk with my mom last night. She just got back from Florida because it's starting to get warm back here in Ohio where I live, and so they're coming back because they live in Florida half the year. And so I just think I've got to witness and see that my entire life, and didn't fully appreciate it until I got older and became a parent myself and realized how much I've been given and how much I'm continually given. And I just think that is a huge responsibility to try to add surplus value in the world, which means you need to give more than you've received. And that is really tough for me because I've been given so much. And so if you want to be a person who adds surplus value and provide more than what you've been given, that is just a never-ending quest. And to me, it's like just constantly looking for opportunities to leave people, places, and things better than I found them, to be overprepared when I meet with people, to pick up the trash when we're walking in the park, right? To think actively and proactively of how to leave these places better than I found them and these people better than I found them. And so that is just how I try to express my thankful value. And it is rich and rewarding and also a great challenge. And I love that. I love it. So that's why I made it one of my values. And that's why I made the critical behavior that. And I think if I live out that value consistently every day, it just seems like good things happen. Cool opportunities arise. amazing people I get to meet, right? Like you in this case, like it just doesn't happen without living out that value. And so I try really hard to do that. And when I do, I get more cool things to do. So it's just like, wow, this is like a cool flywheel. And I'm just grateful that I'm in the middle of it.
I'm going to just jump into one last piece of this book. We've got a chapter 13. In partnerships, we talk about collapsing the time to trust. It's a really important aspect of trying to get progress made, particularly in really tricky circumstances where mission-critical partnerships have fallen apart. You reference the work of Stephen Covey, author of Speed of Trust. As trust goes up, speed goes up and costs go down, and the reverse is also true. Then you went and mentioned General Stanley McChrystal, somebody who I look up to as a veteran, and he said the trust decreases transaction costs. What are some of the things that you do as you meet new people in your life to try and collapse that time to trust?
I think you have to make the trust wager. So the trust wager, again, from Jim Collins and Bill Lazier, is that you can lead with trust and believing people and trusting them without making them earn it. Or you can say, hey, you're going to have to do some work to earn my trust. Mm-hmm. Those are two different ways to approach life. My choice is to lead trusting other people, all people, knowing and being okay with the fact that I will get burned from time to time, and not letting those times switch me to become the other type of person. Warren Buffett has done multi-billion dollar deals after having a 30-minute conversation because he leads with trust. That becomes part of his reputation. People know that that's how he is. So, for example, in my business, I don't do contracts for anything. I don't ask to be paid until after I've done the work for everything. In my world, people would say you are insane for doing it that way. What if you get burned? What if you get stiffed? Well, that happens. Part of it is I want them to know that I expect a lot of myself for the work that I do. And if I don't reach the expectations of both you and me, you're not going to pay me for that work. Even if I flew to you, I don't get the expenses paid or anything, whatever happens. Now, that's also a very trusting way to go about running your business. And again, my accountant says that's not right. My financial advisor says you shouldn't do it that way. And I would say, this is the way I'm going to do it. There are no contracts. There's nothing locked in. I don't make people, like a lot of people in like the coaching consulting world will say, I'm not signing up to work with you unless you lock in a full year because, you know, my stuff takes a year to get going and work. And so I need to take care. I need to be like, make sure I take care of myself. I never say that. I said, you can fire me and not pay for the current work at any time. And this goes for every person I work with. Now, that's because one, that shows them that I, one, believe in my work, but I also trust them. I'm literally putting my money where my mouth is, because if it doesn't work or they don't want to pay me or they just want to stiff me, they can. Now, it's never happened. And I've had my business now since 2017. I've never been stiff. I've never not been paid. Part of that is I think I attract the type of clients that would never do that.
Right.
I think I attract those people. And so I think when you make the trust wager to lead with trust, to not make people earn it, and I think you could sense that, I try to just live that way, you then attract similar type people. And those are high character, awesome clients, very grateful for them. And versus if you're the one who has to go through all these crazy contracts and lawyers and different things and make people earn your trust over the course of many months or years, you're going to attract the cynical type of people who also make others earn their trust. And so you're in this constant battle of, you haven't earned my trust. I worked for a boss like that. I've written about him. I think that was in The Pursuit of Excellence. And that is just such a not fun way to live life. I mean, I would rather live life just trusting people and being okay with the fact that every once in a while someone's going to betray that trust. Okay. Mm. You know, it happens. When it does, it's a huge bummer. Tough to regain it, for sure. Yep. And you move on. But there are a lot of amazing people out there, a lot of great people that are very trustworthy. And so I try to be trustworthy and trustwilling. And when I have lived life that way, it seems to attract similar types of people to me.
What do you think leaders are missing right now about the upside that could be achieved with partnering with other organizations when compared to going it all their own?
You probably have a core competency of what you're really good at, and it's not everything.
Mm.
And the people that you partner with probably have their core competency of what they're really good at, and it's not everything. And so when I look at the partnerships and the people I've hired and the people I've chosen to become part of my team, we're not great at the same things. And we also don't desire to do the same things. Yeah. And so to me, it's like, who can I find that is world-class at this specific skill that I need to make my team better that I'm not that great at, right? I don't want or need people who are world-class at the exact same things that I'm great at. I need people who can fill in gaps and who want to fill in those gaps. And so they desire the thing that I want them to do, and they're really good at it, and I am not, or I don't necessarily want to do it, then that's a great partnership, right? That's what I'm looking for. So sometimes we mistake and only like look for people who are really good at the things we are, or like we're attracted to that. And like I am too a little bit, but for the most part, I'm looking for people who want to do the things that I'm either not that good at or I don't want to do. And that's how I, and then obviously the character things and all of the other like table stakes are part of it, but that's really how I look to it, is the fact that you have a core competency where you're really good. I have that as well, and they're different. Okay, maybe we should team up to attack this thing.
That's it. I had the exact conversation just like that about 2 months ago with the person who now leads marketing for me. She said, I don't do contracts, but here's what I'll do. And we started working the next day, and it's been phenomenal. And I've never had that kind of relationship before, because there have been contracts and agreements and a whole bunch of stuff. But what I've had my eyes open to is this notion that if you do set yourself up for that trust dynamic and you play that wager, it can come back and actually end up delivering extraordinary value. I do worry that there are too many leaders who are worried about the risk of entering into partnerships because they're too worried about all the other things they've got to try and manage in their worlds right now. So what I am hoping over the next, 10 and 15 years is that leaders take a moment to consider, what are they actually genuinely great at? What are they world-class at with their organizations? And where can they afford the time to explore those trusting partnerships to help people, to help their organization grow in a way that they couldn't do otherwise, and be a little bit more flexible with that line of thinking.
And I think be very generous. The best partnerships, the best deal makers are those who don't try to squeeze out every little dollar or don't try to win those deals.
That's it.
It sounds kind of cheesy to say like it make them win-win, but there is something to that. Like, leave something on the table, make it a great deal for them. I think that's one of the biggest things with the people I work with is, I usually ask them what would make it like an amazing deal for them, whether it's financially or the work or
great
a combination
question.
Of everything.
Great question. Yeah.
And then just give it to them or more, give it to them or more. Right. And so you got to do some work to make sure that works for your business, but I'll usually ask that. And then there's no negotiation. There's no like, well, you got to do this, or like, I'll just say, okay, here we go. And then sometimes pleasantly surprise them and give them more at times. I just want them so juiced and excited to do the work with me and my team. And one of the ways is if they're like, well, he's generous. He's thinking of me. He's not trying to squeeze out every little dollar, because like I'm trying to play long-term games. Long term, you're going to win by being really generous with the people that you choose to work with, as opposed to like nickel and diming them on every little thing. Like, they have an expense here or there or whatever. I'm like, what is it? I got you. The thing is, just try to be generous, try to be proactive, try to do things to make them feel loved and special. Like, all of that works in partnerships to where they're like, God, I want to work with him for the rest of my life. That's the type of partnerships that I want. I am curious about your business. So what's your setup? Like, who have you hired? what team members to fill in gaps, and then what do you guys go out and do?
Yeah, so every company I've built over the last 25 years has never had a strong marketing budget, right? We've always had to try and compete in a way which we distributed through partners. We were trying to do product developments with partners. And this is in healthcare. This is in technology. And what we found was that we had this knack for creating relationships which were generous, which where we asked our suppliers, for example, look, this is what we need. You don't do this right now, but what we're trying to achieve is you know, this X end game. And we would spend a lot of time defining what that context and that future looked like. And I was always surprised. They said, well, that's amazing. We never knew that's what you were there to do. So you developed this relationship. We paid all our invoices within 7 days. We did all the things that were very uncommon. And then they started to say to us, well, hey, look, we've got this latent capability. We're happy to give this to you for free. And all of a sudden, there was this leapfrog effect for product developments and go-to-markets where it was quite unexpected. And it was very difficult to explain that to investors because, well, you've not spent anything on this. How did this come about? And we developed this secret sauce for this partnership work. And then, you know, once I retired at my last healthcare venture, I started to take some time out, and colleagues of mine would say, listen, we're trying to grow the way you did in go-to-market with these partnerships, but we would sign the deal and then the deal would just go nowhere. And it's because all of this time was invested in getting a contract that really didn't say anything. It just said, here's how we're going to manage the downside. It had no shared language. It had no trust. It had no shared intent. It certainly didn't have a first fast win that was going to give credit to both sides of the organization. And it didn't do anything to build the depth of relationship and trust between those people. So I built an online course, which gives sort of the 5 tactics to make that work. We give that to all of our client employees. And my day job is building incentive models to make really important strategic partnerships work today and then work in 5 years' time. And so it's all about that generosity of, listen, as long as I understand your intent and you understand mine, and this is for 2 different partners, and it can be in government, can be in not-for-profit, can be in large multinational companies, defense and aerospace, they have they've got an outcome they want to achieve. They can't do it all themselves. Step number 1, they've acknowledged that. Step number 2, they've said, well, we're willing to take a bet. And step number 3, we're willing to put all these things on the table. We just don't know how to organize them. So my job is to organize all of those. So it is the input into a contract or agreement, and then coach the teams of how to build high trust relationships so that I can step out of that organization and that capability is installed. It was an accident, right? I love doing this. I could do this all day, every day, because I love the idea of, you know, 1 + 1 = 6. And I love it when people say, I never saw that partnership coming. That for me lights my head on fire. And so my team is, you know, virtual assistants, some marketing folks, and me. So this is the kind of work that we do, and I really love it.
Very cool, man. Very cool. That's amazing. Yeah. What city are you in?
I'm in Sydney, Australia.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. God, I want to go there so bad, man. I've never been. I need to find a reason to get down there. Find some.
I think we can create a reason. We can create a reason.
Okay. let's figure that out. Cause I want to make it one of those like work trip, but also obviously like see the sites, live it up, because it's not necessarily close to here, but I know it'd be worth it.
It's certainly worth it. Well, listen, let's close this out with one question, which I'd like to ask all my guests. And this is a more of a personal note. Let's go back to you being 20 years old. And given all you've seen, all you've experienced, what's your advice to your 20-year-old self?
I think the caveat with what maybe a lot of people would is that I wouldn't listen, first and foremost. But I will put that here in the corner and just act like I would have listened, because I was too arrogant and full of myself and thought I knew everything. I don't think all 20-year-olds are like that, by the way. Some people say all kids. I don't. I've worked with some of them, and that's not my experience. I think there are some genuinely curious and much better kids than I was at that age. But the number one thing is that I didn't think at all about building relationships. And your life is the who in your life is everything. The people that you choose to intentionally surround yourself with and invest in and pour into those relationships will make your life. And I got introduced, I mean, I played college football, and that created a platform to be introduced to a lot of amazing people in business and sports, throughout the university, the president of the school. I mean, all these people. And I did nothing. I literally did nothing with any of those. Hey, how are you doing? How's it going? I didn't remember their names. I didn't follow up. Literally did nothing. I go back to my apartment. We'd, you know, play video games, do some homework, hang out with our friends, and then get ready for practice. That was my college. And so I just like threw away so many amazing potential opportunities to meet fascinating people by showing zero interest in them and no curiosity and no follow-up at all. And that was partial immaturity, partial ego, partial just being an idiot college kid. And so I would hope that I could somehow get through to that person and say, hey, why don't you actually try to build relationships with these people? Who knows what will happen? But at a minimum, you will leave college with all of these kind of cool people to talk to that have been there and done that, that have really learned some things about life. And the fact that you are not even trying is just a huge mistake. And so I try to, you know, share that with other college kids, like, hey, especially if they play sports like I did, you're going to be like, you're given so much opportunity because of like people look up to you because you can play a sport, you're on a scholarship. Yeah. Yes, work hard and be good at that. You got to do that. But you're going to like make the most of these opportunities that I didn't even think about. And I regret that. I don't think I have regrets. That's a regret. I think there's a lot of people that I think back to. I'm like, God, why don't I even try? And that's just a mistake. So I would tell my younger self, and I would tell others that they should be better at that.
Amazing advice. Hey, where can people go and learn more about your Learning Leader Academy, the podcast, the books? Where are we directing people so they can tap into the amazing resources you've created?
Learningleader.com is the home base for everything. If you're on any podcast app, you can search either Ryan Hawk or Learning Leader, and you will see my show pop up. So learningleader.com, or just search that phrase or my name, Ryan Hawk, and you'll see all the work that I do.
Amazing, man. Hey, thanks for your time. Great catching up, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you, Phil. Really appreciate it, man. I appreciate your prep. It's evident. And just your curiosity, man. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.